It's a Small World Radio production.
I'm Colin Brooks. You are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, the best radio station you'll ever hear.
And now it's time for From the Streets with Bob Law.
I remember when Frankie used to say, if he was not on your radio, then your radio is not really on. If WBAI is not on your radio, then your radio is not really on. It is 11 a.m. on a sunny Saturday morning in the city. Good to have you with me. This is your special invitation to move in a little bit closer to your radio and become a part of this conversation. We've got a number of people we want to talk to, including you, on this edition of From the Streets. You know, we are having what we call conversations in the key of life, and that's essentially what they really are. So come in a little bit closer and get a nice warm beverage. Soon we'll be getting a cool beverage as the weather begins to make more sense for us. But it hasn't been such a terrible winter. It hasn't been really that bad here in New York, at least, although there has been bizarre weather all over the country. This is your invitation. Are y'all ready? Put one hand on your radio. There you go. And join us right here, right now, at 99.5 WBAI. I'm Bob Law. In 1989, at just 15 years of age, who is now Dr. Yusef Salaam, was tried and convicted in the Central Park jogger case. Remember that? Along with four other Black and Latino young men. The exonerated five spent between 7 to 13 years behind bars for crimes they did not commit until their sentences were overturned in 2002. Now, since then, they have been profiled in award-winning films, including the Central Park Five documentary from Ken and Sarah Burns and David McMahon, and most recently, the Emmy Award-winning Netflix limited series When They See Us, written and directed by Ava DuVernay. And over the past two decades, Yusef has become a family man, a father, a poet, an activist, an inspirational speaker, and he continues to utilize his platform to share his story with others and educate the public about the impact of mass incarceration and police violence rooted in our justice system. And he regularly advocates for criminal justice reform, prison reform, and the abolition of juvenile solidarity, confinement, and capital punishment. My Lord. He is also the recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from President Barack Obama. And more recently, has shared his story and stance on current issues on a number of what are called mainstream media, major media outlets, CNN, MSNBC, places like that, NPR, and more. And so one of the reasons that Yusef joins us this morning is because he is running for office. He formally announced his candidacy for a highly coveted city council seat in Harlem's 9th district a few days or a week or so ago. And we wanted to talk about that. Wanted to talk about his decision to run for office. Wanted to talk about just the political landscape from his perspective, because, you know, I've been saying to you here that you've got to take action. You've got to do something. You got to stop trying to revolute on the radio and limit what you do to revoluting on the radio, calling people and offering your assessment, your analysis, very often correct. But once you hang up the telephone as though you had, just by talking on the radio, struck a blow for liberation. We've been saying it's time to take action. And Yusuf Salam seems to have responded to that call. And in addition to everything else that he is doing by way of heightening and lifting the consciousness of his constituents, of his community, of his people, he also is becoming actively engaged in trying to make a difference in dealing with the electoral process. And so we want to talk a little bit about that. Yusuf Salam, welcome. Glad to have you with me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It is definitely a pleasure to be here at this time and in this space to be able to tell this story, this part of this chapter of life.
Yeah, that's remarkable. You do indeed have a story. You know, there's got to be, there have been documentaries about the Exonerated Five, but there's a story. There's a movie starring Denzel Washington as Yusuf Salam. there's a real story in here. We really ought to talk a little bit about just what motivates you. You are not angry at society overall. You might be angry about the conditions we deal with, but you have said that you are better, not bitter. Given what you went through, how would you characterize or identify what it is that makes you better rather than bitter?
You know, it occurred to me when this thing was happening to me that they were trying to really affect the emotional state of myself and therefore continuing the onslaught of our people by making us almost into savages. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is if you know, like when you think about things like martial arts, they say wherever your mind goes, your body follows. This is one of the reasons why a young, slim woman can flip a big man. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as his head is going a specific space, either it's going to break or he's going to follow so that he can ensure that his life is saved. But in this particular circumstance, you know, they've pushed us into the margins of life and made us to become survivors because we, in fact, have that as a part of our DNA. Mm-hmm. And this right here, this whole decision is really, it is a clarion call for us to resuscitate our lives, for us to be able to participate, because if you can become embittered by situations and circumstances, the truth of what Nelson Mandela said, being angry mixed with bitter, he didn't say mixed with, but I'm saying mm-hmm. that because I've also heard the words of Dr. Maya Angelou, but being angry mixed with bitter, it's like drinking poison and expecting your enemy to die. And then Dr. Maya Angelou said, you should be angry, but you must not be bitter. And she says, bitterness is like a cancer. It eats upon the host. It doesn't do anything to the object of its displeasure. But then she teaches us all how we can become alchemists. How can we take that very experience that is supposed to break us, the pressure of life that is trying to turn us into diamonds? How do we take that and transform it into what it's supposed to be, the very thing that will give us life? Mm-hmm. She said, you dance it, you march it, you vote it. Now, this is interesting because in the black and brown community in America, we have been part of the disenfranchised community. We have been disappeared from society on purpose, in fact, because when we read the 13th Amendment, it's Section 2 that tells the full story. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article. What is the article? The article is that slavery is alive and sick through another name, but Congress shall have the power to enforce this article through appropriate legislation. And when we look at all of the conditions that have been heaped upon us, the fact that we have been living in a hypersensitive reality, that psychosocially we've been told that we don't matter, and therefore, if we believe it, we begin to move throughout our lives as if we are mistakes. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is that me being introduced to this system at a very young age of 15, where I was full of hope, dreams, and aspirations, full of the, you know, the idea of the American dream, hadn't yet really truly understood what Dr. Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik Shabazz said, the American nightmare. But truly, in fact, what I'm embarking on today and at this moment, this chapter of my life, is really indicative of the American nightmare. They didn't know who they had. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I was able to be repaired and in fact restored in the very belly of the beast that turned into the womb of America, so that as I was being rebirthed back into society, surviving, I could tell the story so that others could get all that they need.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say, we're talking to Yousef Salaam, and we are aware, most of us are aware of his story, as known then as the Central Park Five. They are now the Exonerated Five, because it has been proven without a doubt that they were innocent of the crime. But they spent some years in prison nonetheless, and have come out of prison with the challenge to carve out a meaningful life for themselves, their families, and not allow this system to crush and destroy them, as it does with so many people who go to prison. So many people who go to prison and come out of prison more criminally inclined than when they went in. There's really nothing happening in prison to rebuild the spirit of the people who are incarcerated, other than those people themselves who seek. There are many people who are in prison who look for a way up and out that gives them back their lives. And Yousef now has decided to run for office. And it's an interesting decision. It is something that I've been saying here, that we want to see young people become involved in the electoral process. And when we say that, Yousef, a lot of people say it doesn't make any difference. They're going to do what they want to do anyway. Yeah, you know, in this last mayoral election, 80% of the registered voters did not vote. Only 20% of the registered voters voted in the final general election, and it took a peculiar little strategy called ranked choice voting to even get come up with a candidate that could actually run for office in the general election. There's a lot of I don't know exactly what that is, apathy or disheartened, discouraged. When you look at that and decide to run for office nonetheless, what is your thinking about motivating people just to get involved and vote in the first place?
I mean, that's the very thing that the 13th Amendment is really pushed upon us. Right. I mean, if we become part of the disenfranchised community, whether it is by choice or not, then we can't participate in the process of voting. But imagine those individuals, like you said, who have become so disenchanted. They have been divested, and they participate in it. And so therefore they say, why even participate? You know, mm-hmm. The most powerful thing I've ever heard someone say is that non-participation is in fact participation. If we step back and just realize that the whole of our lives is governed by political processes, the very streets that we walk on, the fact that there are potholes that are being filled in some communities and not in others, the fact that garbage is being picked up, the fact that safe communities look very different in different spaces, even in Harlem, very, very different. The collective idea is divide and conquer. The collective idea that is present in the minds of our people is I have to only care for myself. And the truth of the matter is that we've never been that kind of people. But someone has planted that same seed of destruction in our minds and in our hearts. It's the same idea that has been planted in our communities that says we are going to be dead or in jail before we reach the age of 21. Mm-hmm. And the challenge that I've always posed to young people in particular, as they think about that, as they consider that, as they mull it around, as they taste it, is that if you had the opportunity to plan your life, what would you do and how would your plans look? And would you include in that plan that you're going to be dead or in jail before you reach the age of 21? Almost every young person I've spoken to said, absolutely not. I will not do that. And the question is, why is that seed of evil being watered in our community? And so black and brown bodies and people who have been made to believe that they are totally poor, meaning poor in money, but mm-hmm. poor in value and poor in mental state, then they completely pull over to the side of the highway of life. They don't even put on their blinkers to signal that they need help. The most important thing in our lives is making sure that we do not leave this world without a trace. And what does that mean? That means we always celebrate our birthday. At the end of our lives, people know our death date. But the most important thing in our lives is the dash in between those two mm-hmm. dates. What did we do with our life? Mm-hmm. How did we participate? How did we reinvigorate and pump new life back into society? Harlem is beautiful, and the soul and the spirit of Harlem is still alive and well. But there has been a concerted effort in order to make people believe that they should not participate in their own growth and development. And the truth of the matter is that my mother said this to me, and she, you know, I get everything. Everything I get is from my mother. My mother said to me at 15 years of age, they need you to participate in whatever it is they are trying to do. Do not participate. Refuse. And so imagine taking that same wisdom into the prison. I would have turned into a monster had I not remembered in a Sankofa way what my mother had planted in me. Imagine me taking that back out into the world as I'm rebirthed into society, having all of the doors of success shut in my face. In fact, being known then as the Central Park Five, they wanted to have us receive a social death if we happened to survive prison.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that they...
Wait. Let's kind of just walk through that again for a minute. Let's make sure that everybody is clear. They wanted you to receive a social death. You said regardless of what happened in prison?
Yeah. If I happened to survive.
If you happened to survive prison, you would still die on a social death, which is what happens to a lot of people who think they have survived prison, as well as a lot of other people who think they have survived not going to prison and don't understand that social death is still there. Can you talk a little bit about that social death, what you mean by that?
This is important. I mean, think about it. Our birthright is that God gave us the ability to be here. God, in fact, said to all of us, every single one of us, be. And here we are. Therefore, we don't have to ask permission to live. Many of us have been asking permission. We've been asking to be seen. We've been trying to get the system to see the content of our character as opposed to the color of our skin. And we don't have to ask permission to live. And so being given a social death and participating in that, in fact, is completely checking out from the process. I mean, think about this. Mm-hmm. They say no taxation without representation. And if you fail to pay your taxes, as we've seen some of the giants in different industries, unfortunately, have fallen because of their failure to pay taxes, you go to jail. So no taxation without representation is there to ensure that our tax dollars afford opportunities for equity for all of us. the truth of the matter is that we have not been afforded equity. We have not been given equality. We have been told, we'll take it from here. And therefore, we, in many ways, and we shouldn't have to do this, we don't micromanage where our dollars go. We don't budget where our dollars go. We just pay our taxes and hope for the best. And in fact, we've been hoping for the best for too long. It's now time to request and require and to ensure that our tax dollars go exactly where they're supposed to go. Because imagine when we were found innocent, after the 12 years afterwards of us fighting for justice, we were found innocent in 2002. In 2014 is when we received financial compensation for the injury of going to prison. Imagine that. The money that was paid to us came from the tax dollars. Just like the huge budgets that we require for our safety are being, that money is being poured in, or those coffers, those buckets are being poured into from the very tax dollars that we are paying. And so to be told, don't participate, and to believe that we have been cursed, right? That old idea of the curse of Ham. We look at the color of our skin. Now, ourselves, we look at ourselves and we look at the color of our skin, and some of us believe that we were cursed. We've been literally sat in the window of life, and others get an opportunity to look in the mirror of life, and everything reflects them. But we are looking out of a window as life goes by. It's time for us to get up and start moving with the sense of urgency of now, because we don't have to tomorrow. This, even my candidacy, it's not about the moment of the seat that is Harlem's seat. It's not about that moment. It is about the movement of that ripples into the future of what does this mean for us as a people? Because if Yusuf Salam, Dr. Yusuf Salam, as I've been called, has been able to stand up and straighten his back, then how am I even going to use the argument that I need to remain bowed? No, we got to all stand up, because they need us to participate. They want us to be able to have their social debt willingly, as opposed to some other person or system telling us exactly what it is. But the truth of the matter is that if we look with the eyes that we have been given, and we can see and we understand what's going on, they don't want you to participate. That number that you gave about the voting participation, if we don't think that there is absolute power in that, then why is the concerted effort to disappear our young men? And even now, even our young women are being disappeared, trying to divest them from the process of being able to participate as part of the franchise. This is where we are.
Again, we're talking with Yusuf Salam. Yusuf Salam has announced his candidacy. He is going to run for the city council seat in Harlem, the community where he grew up. We pointed out that he has done a number of things since coming out of prison, and all of them have been extremely impressive, based on his principled idea of not being destroyed by a system that fully intends to destroy, to break spirits, to break your heart, to break your spirit. Understanding that, he then begins to take steps to make sure that that does not happen to him, and then steps into a leadership position. Did I mention also there was a Lifetime Achievement Award from President Barack Obama in 2016, and Yusuf Salam, who is now Dr. Yusuf Salam. And how old were you when you went to prison?
My God, I was at the tender age of 15 years old, still a child. And even if we consider the eldest of us, Corey Wise, he was still a child at the age of 16.
15 years old and sent to prison, and Corey, 16 years old, sent to prison, innocent of any crime, guilty of being black in New York City.
Black in America.
Yeah, this, I'm telling you. And so out of all of that comes a campaign to keep hope alive. You said that we need to not give up hope. Giving up is exactly what the enemies of our people intend us to do. So when people say that it's no point in engaging in the political process, it's no point in voting, it's no point in dealing with any of that, they and they say it as though that is the result of some careful, critical thinking on their part, when in fact it is simply reflecting what they have been programmed to do. This is a political system. Even with the elected officials who are already incumbents, the incumbents are invisible in our community until it is time to be reelected. And the community seems to tolerate that somehow. The people get reelected even without campaigning, even without doing any real work for their constituents. People still get reelected. The community just seems to be very tolerant, and in many cases entirely too tolerant, with a mediocre kind of leadership that produces very little. We're going to look at some other things that are happening right in New York City, for instance, as this conversation continues, as we start to look closer at what it is that we are up against. And so we're pleased, though, that somebody has decided to take up the challenge to challenge the media, what I'm calling, and I'm right, to challenge the mediocre leadership. A lot of the problem that we have in this political arena is because the leadership is so mediocre. The you know, it's communities who do better, like Yusef, you mentioned, even if you go through Harlem, you can find places throughout the community that are different than other places, where the quality of life is even better. And you can do that certainly going throughout the entire city. But the people who live in other neighborhoods, the people who live on the Upper West Side, and the people who live in Riverdale, and you know, just people who live in communities where the quality of life is better, they are not necessarily smarter or more engaged. They might be a little more engaged because they get what they want from the people who represent them. But it is not that all of those people are so smart and so engaged, as much as it is the people who represent them actually look out for their best interests. That doesn't happen in the Black community. And it's one of the things that we are looking at that needs to be done, that kind of challenge that needs to be done. We're about to run out of time. Yusef Salaam.
We got to do a part two, brother.
That's right. But I wanted to talk about your decision to run for office. And what it was that made you decide to do that. I don't know, did we make that clear enough? There are a lot of things that you were doing
that you could continue to do.
Run for office is another whole pathway altogether. You want to just conclude this conversation, making it clear why you decided to run?
Absolutely. You know, it occurred to me, and it occurred to me a long time ago, that we have to agitate and march and protest when things go wrong. But who is there in the halls of power to give our voices ear? Those individuals who have been closest to the pain should have a seat at the table, especially if they can think their way through and articulate this whole chessboard that we have been playing. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, we may always say, man, I wish somebody can. That person is me. Mm-hmm. That person is you. That person is us participating in a high value, raising our vibrations to a higher level because we know we were born on purpose. We know that this ain't right. We know almost all of us are now like Neo in the Matrix, saying something ain't right and something hasn't been right. And we need champions to be able to take the voices of those who have been turned all the way down into the halls of power so that their voices are echoed by a champion, by a hero, by leadership that mm-hmm. has their back. And if anyone has the people's back in Harlem, it is the very son of Harlem, the very person that came out of Harlem, who is back here in many ways almost at the scene of the crime, to pull other people out of the fire so that we can have not just life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness now, but we're talking about something that's going to ripple into the future generations yet to come. And so the urgency of now is upon us. This is not politics as usual. This is definitely something different. And the beautiful thing about it is that my voice, my platform has been given to me mm-hmm. at 15 years age, almost 34 years ago. And it is now, what do we do with that platform that makes all of the difference? Running for political office has been a very important decision in my life because I could have, like you said, been doing anything else. But mm-hmm. I decided to take back my life and assist and become a servant of the people. And that's what it's really all about.
Yusuf Salam, thank you for spending this morning with us, getting these conversations in the key of life into the air. Thank you so much. We need to talk again as things continue, and we'll do that. But thank you for coming with us, being with me this morning. I wanted people to just hear from you and hear your decision to the basis for your decision to run for office, because it is precisely what I've been asking folks to do. Get involved. Yes, don't buy into sitting down, sitting it out. So hip, so politically sophisticated, know so much better than everybody else the fallacies and the contradictions in this system. So I'm going to step away from it. And then people step away from it like that was their idea. Mm. We are trying to point out, as Malcolm said, you've been had. You've been took. You've been bamboozled. Thank you, Yusuf. Thank you for being with me. We're going to call again. All right?
My pleasure. My pleasure. And thank you as well.
All right now. I'm Bob Law. This is WBAI. We're at 99.5 in New York City. We're looking at what we are up against in the political arena here in this city, as well as in this country, really, and in the world. What are we up against? And because a certain kind of response is required of us, a certain kind of response is really necessary. And it becomes our challenge. And see, there's some things happening in the Black community, however, that are confusing, where we want to do for self, and everybody does for self. But when we talk about it in the Black community, there are people who say that that is divisive. If we talk about reparations, you know, there are people who say that reparations for Black people, because there are other people already being paid reparations now. But reparations for Black people, we are told, is divisive. And, you know, there's the idea that we should not pursue what we have determined is in our own best interest. See, that is part of the problem. We set out as a Black community to determine what is in our own best interest. And then some confusion sets in with people saying that what is in your best interest is what is in the interest of all people. And so don't look for those things that affect Black people in particular. That is narrow nationalism. Although I haven't heard folks say narrow nationalism in a long time. I don't know that they have learned better. I just haven't heard them say and use the term narrow nationalism, and it only applies to Black people. The you know, there's articles about how the Asian community is beginning to drift to the right. Now, one of the reasons that the Asian community is drifting to the right is that they feel, the leadership and I guess the members of the community, they feel that the maintain the status quo agenda of the right works in their interest, even though the right is wicked, liars, criminals, extortionists, you know, all of this stuff that is happening on the right. Even though all of that wickedness is on the right, the Asian community says we can live with the wickedness because the other things that they are doing, whatever that might be, they are that right-wing position works in the interest of the Asian community. And nobody accuses them of narrow nationalism. There's nobody saying that you have to look beyond what you consider in your own specific interest and look at the larger issues. That is the position that is reserved for us, for Black folk only. Wonder why that is. And so that is one of the things that where we need some clarity. If we look at what we are up against in this society, and look at what we're up against here in New York City. See, when we say that we want the Black elected officials to address the needs of the Black community, we don't mean that they address the needs of the Black community at the expense of others. We don't mean that they should only deal with the issues affecting Black people. What we're saying is that they should identify one or two key issues that have a devastating effect on the lives of Black people and address those issues, make a point to address those issues while at the same time continuing to do all the other things that they have a need to do, addressing the issues and concerns that affect everybody throughout the city. But what happens is that the needs of the Black community are overlooked. And only what can be described as general issues are addressed. And that is problematic for us. But I think part of the problem is that we are really, as a community, we are not really fully aware of what we are up against. You know, when we look at what's happening in New York City, and let's just look for a minute at the condition of the Black community. There's a lot of things, there are a lot of things that are happening in the Black community that are very evident right up on Front Street. There's homelessness, there's high unemployment, there's violence on the streets, there's a lack of businesses, Black-owned businesses. If you go through the Black community, you drive down certain streets around the city, Ostrand Avenue, Farmers Boulevard, just the streets around the city that go right through the heart of the Black community. They are food deserts. There's just staggering unemployment, and which we believe adds to a higher than normal street crime, violence, and murder in the Black community. It's all related to the collapse of social institutions. The social collapse of the Black community is what Yusuf Salam was talking about, dying a social death. We are dying, we are suffering that social death in the Black community, but it is because the issues that need to be addressed are being ignored. You know, I believe that it is very much a issue of priorities, where our priorities are, what kind of things that we are doing and not doing. You know, if we look at some research that says over the last 20 years, Black New York has lost about 15% of its homeowners and about 5% of its total population. See, this means that Black New Yorkers as a group are smaller, poorer, and more vulnerable, despite the high number of Black elected officials. See, there's a peculiar gap in here. Everybody in a key position, everybody in New York City is Black. The public advocate, the attorney general, Manhattan district attorney, the mayor, the police commission, chancellor, city council, predominantly, just is so much stuff. We're everywhere. You would think that with all of that Black representation in office, that the conditions in the Black community would be more stable than they are. It is a question of priorities. What kinds of things are being addressed? What kind of things are being ignored? You know, we want to see if we can be clearer about what we're up against. And if we can be clearer about what is happening right up under our nose, if we're going to say that we need a new kind of visionary leadership, then perhaps we need to lay out why we say so. You know, according to the 2020 census, Bed-Stuy, right here in Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy gained more than 30,000 white residents between 2010 and 2020, more than almost any other neighborhood in New York City, while more than 22,000 Black residents have left the neighborhood. Harlem gained more than 18,000 white residents since 2010, while Black population has declined by 10,805. And even the Hispanic population has dropped by about 2,000. People are leaving and leaving the communities, leaving the neighborhoods that where they grew up, where they were homeowners. And it's not that they just decided they wanted to get away from the winter. Like me, I want to get away from the winters. But it's not that they wanted to get away from the winter. It is that they are being pushed out of their homes by gentrification. We need to understand how gentrification is so possible, because it's related to deed theft. It is illegal and immoral foreclosures. There's a whole policy in place that is clearing the land, making it available to other people who are moving in, taking advantage of the illegal, immoral practices that are making these homes even available. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment with Yolanda Richardson Nicholson and her organization, the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar. Want you to be clear what we're up against, but let me get your thoughts. Knocking over my brand new equipment here. as we move to the top of the hour, just before the conversation with Attorney Nicholson, you can call me right now, 212-209-2877. Let me just put some ideas on the table. There's a front page article in the Sunday Times, something that we've mentioned here before, and it talks about how excuse after excuse, Black and Latino developers struggle to expand. The article says that a racial wealth gap and discrimination that sets a higher bar for would-be developers seeking loans have contributed to the lack of representation of roughly, now listen to this, of roughly 112,000 real estate development companies in the United States. 112,000 real estate development companies in the United States. About 111,000 of them are white owned. Out of the 112,000 real estate development companies in the United States, 111,000 of them are white owned. Now, they say these numbers are bad, but at the top of the market, they're even worse. Of 383 top-tier developers that generate more than $50 million in revenue annually, one is Latino, and none are Black. That's according to a new report. Now, and the Black developers that we've spoken to and say that excuse after excuse, Black and Latino developers struggle to expand. It's not that they can't do the work. It is that access to capital is not there. It is the when during the mayor's race, when we interviewed the candidates here on BAI, when I interviewed the candidates, we asked them if they would commit to giving 20% to 30% of the development contracts to Black developers in order to close that gap. And that wasn't charity. That was because Black and Latino developers have been deliberately and systematically denied based on racism. And every study that has been conducted has concluded that. And so we say that in order to repair the damage, understand what reparations is. It's not a gift. It is intended to repair the damage, and the damage that is caused by deliberate policy. And so in order to repair the damage, and let's all start to play on a little bit better playing field, a little bit more level playing field, repair the damage. And would you commit to giving 20 to 30% of the development contracts in New York City, which is into the billions of dollars annually? Would you give 20 to 30% to Black developers? And each of the candidates said they would. Eric Adams said that he definitely would, and he definitely has not. And those things like increasing the amount of money set aside for minority developers, it's not even close to what we're talking about. Very deliberately, very specifically, address the damage done by racist policy to Black and brown developers. Address that. Whatever else you have to do, you do. Whatever the other kind of things you're dealing with as mayor, deal with that. But here's the issue that will make a significant difference in the quality of life for Black folk and for the entire Black community. That's what we mean by the priorities are off. So see, rather than do that, the mayor announces that they're going to increase the amount of money set aside for minorities. And when they set aside for minorities, in each of those scenarios, the Black folk included in that minority group wind up getting 1 to 2%. Everybody becomes a minority. White women representing their husbands, everybody, Asians, everybody. And so the money really does not address, it really does not address the real issue of lending institutions and banks being allowed to get away with racist policy that denies Black folk access to capital, even though they are qualified. And so that's one of the, that's some of what we are up against. And I'm moving to the top of the hour, and I'll take your calls if you call me right now. I know we give you a lot to think about, but call me if you have some time to think it over with what you have heard so far, because there's a lot more. on this particular conversation in the Key of Light. And again, part of my concern is that we are being told not to think in terms of what is in our own best interest as a group, as though you cannot address the needs of a particular group who have been targeted and become the victims of a particular behavior, that we cannot address that. And I'm saying that that is nonsense. You must address the issues at that level and then continue to do whatever else is part of your platform, your agenda, that is going to improve the quality of life for everybody. But for too long, while we have marched with everybody, sit in with everybody, sang in with everybody, stood with everybody, and we really have, the more so than anybody else, and still, those very specific conditions that affect Black people are ignored. So I think that's wrong. I think that we have a right to require of the leadership that while they address all the issues, they must address what affects us specifically as well. And not necessarily everything that affects us, but they need to be able to point to at least healthcare, this whole issue of development and economic development, and the way that the developers are able to generate income into the Black community. And again, these contracts, these development contracts, that's not charity. The cities who give out these contracts, they're giving out these contracts, taking money from their tax revenue. That's where the money comes from. And so we're spending as much money as anybody else and still can't get a fair share returned. And they talk to us as though we're asking for a handout. My Lord. 212-209-2877. Let's see how many people I can get to before we reach the top of the hour. Hey, this is Bob Lloyd. We're at WBAI. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to know if I could chime in on the city council piece, because I've been to numerous hearings and investigations of city council because I live in NYCHA. For instance, when NYCHA had resident engagement, is the committee that's supposed to sit with the presidents of tennis associations. They claim they call people and do all this kind of crap. I went to that investigator. The problem with city council is they investigate city agencies, but they don't go to the agency, kick the door in, and arrest people. Mm-hmm. They can't do what's needed to be done. Yeah, they can have hearings, but it takes the people, just like you said, that 80% that decided they ain't going out to vote because maybe they just have a witness or they just ain't down no more because the system is this and that. That 80%, if somebody can get in their ear, like what I be trying to do, trying to get into their ear, because HUD gives NYCHA Tennis Associations millions of dollars to do programs. They give it to them. Okay, you can go right to the TPAF site. You can Google it, and you'll see every NYCHA development from A to Z, how much money they have in their TPA funds. It's just sitting there, and we ain't spending it. And that money is for your family days, if you want to create something for your youth, something for your elderly or whatever. You do it with a consultant. NYCHA provides the consultants for you, all of this, and we're just not doing it. And I'm going to tell you something too, Bob, what I really, really think our problem is. Our problem is... it's just like Stillwell said in his commentary. He said that it's mobbed rule. It is mob rule. move. And that's why we can't, because once these TA leaders, they're supposed to be for the working with the residents, but once a lot of them get in, they get on management side, because the TAs are supposed to be the conduit between management and tenant.
And now, wait. Let me just see if I can get somebody else in before we get to the top of the hour and have to turn the page. But I appreciate your call, and I appreciate that insight. That's very helpful. You can reach me right now, 212-209-2877. I'm Bob Law. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
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 All right, now.
Hello.
Well, I'm going to have to move to the next caller. Hello.
Hello.
I've heard you three times.
Okay. Well, you didn't answer me back, so I
did. Yes, I did. Go right ahead.
Okay, so this is Cruz. I live in Central Harlem. Mm-hmm. I was listening to Dr. Salam. I was hoping he would actually lay out his platform or his agenda.
Well, that's not what this conversation was for quite yet.
Really? Okay.
I'm not able to let him do that. On this kind of radio, I don't know if they're allowed.
Well, you brought him on, and the week before, you mentioned the councilwoman, who's African-American, and I was hoping at some point you would even bring her on or even have them, you know, discuss the issues, since you're talking about Black empowerment, right? And it is Women's History Month, and Black women have done a whole lot that has not been acknowledged recently by the Black and the rest of the world. So, yeah, I was hoping that could get done at some point.
Well, me too. I hope it can get done at some point.
Yeah,
I'll make it happen.
Maybe do some outreach to both of them and, you know.
Yeah, I know what to do. Yeah. I don't know how much I'm allowed to do on public radio is what I'm saying. But, yes, I will try to do that. And I do know that we can bring candidates, as we did with the forums that we did with the mayor's race. I can do that, and we will.
Yeah, that sounds like something I would love to hear, you know, because you have a lot of people that live in Central Harlem that I know listen to your show. So that would be great.
They just need to listen to me. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
But we'll make that happen, though. That's a good idea.
I think we can do that even on
public radio. We can do that. So we'll make that happen. Thanks for your idea.
Thank you so much. You have
a good day. 212-209-2877. If I can get you on the air right now. Hello.
Yeah. I'm speaking about what's going on in Bed-Stuy. Like Bed-Stuy, those brownstones over in Bed-Stuy used to sell for like maybe $50,000 at the most. But now, we have brownstones over there now. Each one of those brownstones are worth like $1,200,000.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those elderly people that are living in these houses can't keep up with the tax burdens. You know, like there's a big tax burden that comes along with that $1,000,000. And the younger people that are inherited these houses, they're not trying to hold on to them. They're saying, well, I'm take the money. I'm going down south. I'm going somewhere. And they're selling out to anybody that comes along with that $1,000,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I heard...
That's not exactly true.
I heard, like, the other day where Adams has passed this bill. He's trying to... cut down on the tax burdens for the people, for the older people in Bed-Stuy. We have to hold him to the feet on that, hold him to the fire on that, you know, because that's why a lot of these older people can't hold on to these places. They can't. So call this office and tell him you passed this bill saying that, you know, you're going to try to do...
Well, that's exactly what I want you to do. When we talk about things like this,
but other people can do it too. I did it.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. I want you to do it, but I mean you only. But we've been saying that here for some time. You've got to stop revoluting on the radio. get on the radio, say, this is so-and-so and so, and hang up as though that makes a difference. You've got to take additional steps. And like you say, call his office. We've talked about a number of things where we could have called his office. But I don't know that the issue is that people are losing their homes because they can't afford the tax burden. I don't believe that is exactly correct, but we're going to find out in a moment. We're moving into a conversation with Attorney Nicholson, who has been dealing with this issue of home ownership and what has been happening to Black homeowners for some years now. She raised this back on March 15th, 2019, and she made some things really very, very clear. And she's going to join us in this conversation in a moment. She points out that the rising tide, a foreclosure epidemic across New York State, the targeted destabilization and gentrification of Black and brown communities, hardest hit by the fallout of subprime lending and unfounded denials of loan modifications in the state court's rocket docket proceedings. She's going to explain what that is, what's happening with that again, because that has a great deal to do with how it is that people are unable to hold on to their property. It is absolutely not true that people are losing their property simply because they can't afford the tax burden. That is a real distortion of what is actually happening politically. And that's one of the things that we want to really push back against, that kind of disinformation and incomplete information. Somehow, it always comes back down to the victim has brought it on themselves. Somehow. My. I'm Bob Law, and we're about to turn the page. We're at WBAI 99.5. Moving into a conversation with Attorney Yolande Nicholson, as president of the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar. Moving a little bit closer to your radio, we're looking for some clarity. We're looking for some to better understand what we are up against. Therefore, we can better, as a result, we can better understand the kind of things that we need to do in order to move forward. So let me give you a minute to exhale. I wonder when was the last time you heard. So, you know, one of the things about WBAI is that the BAI really does play the best music on radio in New York City without even having a music show. But it does play the best music on radio in New York City. Yeah, moving a little bit closer to your radios, as we start to turn the page in this conversation in the key of life. You remember this song, Bring It, Sean. This is 99.5 WBAI in New York City, and we're moving into a conversation with Yolanda Nicholson, Esquire. She is president of the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar, and one of the people who raised this issue many years ago in an effort to protect the homeowner, the level of home ownership in Black communities. And she has pointed out in the past that chaos in housing and foreclosure matters continue on a fast track. And that was back in 2019. There's a number of things that are going on. And as the last caller indicated, there may be some confusion. There may be not clear enough as to what accounts for the condition that we find ourselves in. And Yolanda Nicholson, Attorney Nicholson, can kind of help us understand even better how it is that so many homes are become available, so many homes are the home ownership is disappearing, but it is not from neglect, and it is not from people who just can't pay their taxes. There's a whole process in place that we need to better understand. Attorney Nicholson, are you with me?
Hi, good morning. Could you hear me?
Hey. Yes, we can hear you fine.
How are you?
Thank you for joining us right here, right now. Let's just kind of look at, you raised this issue about all of the schemes and scams that are in place that are taking property away from people. And it was back in, as we said, it was back in, was it 2015, 2019?
2018 or 19.
Yeah, March 15th. But
yes,
it was
March
back
15th
in,
is when I testified, yes.
Right. And so let's just talk quickly what it is that accounts for this loss of home ownership. We look at the numbers, we look at how people, we have said earlier, so I'm going to find that again, that people are losing their homes. The population in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn has shifted, where at least 20,000 people have lost their homes. Another, or 18,000 people have lost their homes. Another 80. Now, why is it I can't find that note right now?
That's okay. I have some numbers to share with you that will back you up.
Okay, good. You go right ahead.
Good morning. I'm sorry I'm a little hoarse, but it's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for always bringing this topic to the fore. You know, you ask a big question, which has a big answer, but there are parts of it. But the big answer is I've really come to the conclusion since we've spoken, Bob, that there is a systemic scheme in place to divest Black people of African descent, of home ownership in America, but especially in New York. We've experienced it firsthand in New York. And why? You know, the fundamental rights of Americans is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I listened to your show earlier. I listened to the candidate who's going to be running, and thank God for him and his courage. But you can't build community. You can't have community without home ownership. So historically, when we celebrated, I heard you talk about back in the day, you were reminiscing a little bit. I was reminiscing this morning with a friend when you could drive down Flatbush Avenue or drive across Fulton Street in the 90s and the 80s, and you were in a Black community. You were in a Black community. You could go to the store and buy your vegetables, get your dry cleaning done. You could see somebody you went to church with or you went, down the street and said hi. That has been busted up. And it's not as a result of people not wanting to inherit and pay the taxes. There are a lot of myths to cover up the systemic taking of Black homes, from starting with the subprime lending crisis, which targeted African-American communities that had actually strived and bought their homes with cash, as the caller said, for $50,000. But the financial industry knew that these communities were sitting there now with homes that they bought without mortgages, and they unleashed mortgage brokers on them, and I'm not blaming the mortgage brokers, to suck that value out, and knowing that eventually those mortgages will be untenable because those mortgages required constant refinancing to be untenable, and that's not a reality. And then you've got, you couple with that, what I've learned since I've spoken to you, just how upzoning. Everybody is talking about all these big edifices going up across our communities. People are presenting them as though they're solving affordable housing crisis and lack of housing crisis. They're not, because none of those units are available to African-American families in particular. Most families, but we're the ones most affected, that are, you know, median income, civil servants, teachers, you know, $55,000, $45,000. The new building that's going to be going up downtown Brooklyn, you got to make between $85,000 and $156,000 to live in the affordable unit. To live in the affordable unit. Then you take East New York, Nehemiah. When they upzone, they put the community on blast. And the developers come in and they build high towers and they devalue your property because they're encroaching on your property. And then you bring in the mix with the courts who completely, and I can say this now publicly, who believe firmly as a system that it's their duty to take away black home ownership with the stamp of a judge and a court, that we are not entitled to own homes, we are not deserving to own homes, and they are on track and have succeeded at the massive loss in black home ownership that we've experienced in Brooklyn and Queens in particular. Just this month, just this week, we have over 50 Brooklyn homes on the auction block in Kings County. So people got to pay attention to the numbers. And you were talking about the numbers. The black population in Crown Heights, Ocean Hill, Bed-Stuy, Weeksville, that area, yes, it went down by 10%, but the white population experienced an almost 700% increase. So it's not, it's what are they doing? The system, they're taking back the communities. And that just doesn't mean that, that doesn't mean that we're at war with our white brothers and sisters. But we all have to acknowledge that we live in a system where the pursuit of happiness through land ownership is something that the system has not come out publicly and says, black people, it is their time. It is now their time to be given the reparations so that they can enjoy being full American citizens.
So now, when I look at these numbers again, the we were looking at the 2020 census data that says that Bed-Stuy gained more than 30,000 white residents between 2010 and 2020, more so than almost any other neighborhood in New York City, while more than 22,000 black residents have left the neighborhood. Now, what we're looking at and trying to be really clear about is left the neighborhood. Did they simply pack up and leave? Or is there some other process in place that is driving people out of the neighborhood?
It's a combination of things. It's a combination of things. A lot of the Bed-Stuy homes were targeted for subprime lending and went into foreclosure because a lot of the mortgages were solicited. The families were encouraged to take out mortgages to fix the kitchen or pay taxes or do whatever on rental income. Once the recession hit 10 years ago, we're still experiencing the recession. So people who say it's over, I just want to remind black people especially, we first have to own this. We're still experiencing the recession. So when they lost their tenant income, someone fixed income, but primarily a lot of the tenants were civil servants. They went into foreclosure. The courts were not willing, despite the law that says they have to loss mitigate. The courts put systems in place to undo the law so that black people didn't get modifications. Then the government started selling these loans to these equity investors, Wall Street investors, foreign investors, knock on doors and force people to sign their deeds over to them or cajole them or put fear in them. And then they started deed theft. And then you add that with the upzoning that has happened to allow these tall edifices to go up to bring in and house the population increase that you're seeing from the non-black community. And then you add on top of that that those units are not available or affordable to the people in the community and to most Black people. So that's why, you know, to use Mr. Youssef's term, we are dying a social death here in Brooklyn and maybe in Queens and in Harlem. He's right. They've experienced it. And it's a systemic scheme to divest us. And people who say it's gentrification, market forces, maybe young people didn't want to inherit the house. Tell me which young person doesn't want to have a house, a brownstone in Brooklyn right now. I mean, that's just not a reality. I have a lot of young people fighting to keep their homes that they inherited from their parents. I get calls about it all week. But the forces keep coming at them to make it impossible for them to keep their homes. And then you layer on top of that the city's tax lien program. So once the community upticks where a brownstone is selling for $1.5 million and the city taxes at that value, the 70-year-old or 65-year-old or the child who inherited it got to pay taxes that's five or 10 or 15 or 20 times. And if they don't, the tax lien gets sold into a Wall Street trust, and that Wall Street trust is allowed to come take the home. So it's, you know, these are not short-term players. These are long-term players to take the Brooklyn Black communities back. Flatbush, East Flatbush, Ocean Hill, Brownsville, East New York, Bed-Stuy, Crown Heights. And Black people need to realize that I think it's over. But, you know, I don't want to be hopeless. You've given me hope this morning listening to your first guest this morning. It's good when young people, but they've got to be educated on what they have to do at the table at City Hall and at the Capitol to save their community.
We want people to be more aware what we're up against, the kinds of, and also, what can be done about it? There are Black people, we think, in policy-making positions in New York City, for sure. There are Black folk everywhere in leadership positions. We're wondering, can any of them do anything about any of this? You know, we have an attorney general. Is there a role that an attorney general can play? There's a mayor of New York City. There's members of the city council. You know, you wonder how all of this happens right up under their nose. Is it that they really just don't realize what is happening? I see an article in Politics New York about the headline says Black and Hispanic owned properties being targeted by socialist lawmakers. And there's an organization called Good Cause Eviction. And it has been described really as a scheme to make it possible for people, gentrifiers who are moving into some of these properties to not have to pay rent and to be able to stay there. But it doesn't sound like that when they say, what is a good cause eviction? You know, what does that mean? And I don't know if you're aware of this group. They have raised this issue. But I don't see anything happening, on that level of activism on behalf of the homeowners who are losing their property. Your thoughts about that?
You're exactly right. You know, homeowners are, because, you know, homeowners are, there's no large umbrella organization championing their cause. And we have to remember, and I'm mindful of your time, that when this crisis started, it was the financial markets and the financial press and the general press, you know, blamed Black homeowners for the crisis, blamed the victim, as you said earlier, to say, oh, you shouldn't have gotten into this loan if you knew you couldn't afford it. You can't afford this loan. And that sort of racial profiling worked its way into the court system and into the larger area to say, let's remove these deadbeat black people or these, you know, unable black people from the burden of a mortgage. But to be more specific, you know, I think we in New York State, I have to say, our New York State legislature has done more than any other legislature to put laws in place to protect home ownership. And every time we ask them to step up and tighten something up, they do. But we have a court system, and I'm not being personal to anybody. I'm just being in general. Democracy is threefold. It's legislative, executive, and judiciary. We have a court system that has now been totally shut down and unavailable to providing justice, equity, fairness to anybody that looks like me or you if we show up, especially if we're a homeowner. We have somebody said earlier, mob rule. So what we've got to do is to find a way to either remove the attention of saving home ownership from the New York State Supreme Court that's sitting at 360 Adams Street and in some of the other counties, or remove the political chokehold of mob bosses really on the decision making and the application of the law when it comes to tenants. The good cause eviction is overall something I agree with, because I've been the victim of bad cause eviction and just won a major case at the second department where I was evicted on what turned out to be a fraudulent, illegal rent and lease. But I can fight that fight. What about someone who can't fight that fight? Mm-hmm. Where are the forces in the courthouse? Where are the forces at the Attorney General's office? Where are the forces at the city level that says, if we give a developer money to build affordable housing, why are we not enforcing the laws to keep it affordable? Why are we not making sure the courts are not violating the laws that the legislature put in place to save home ownership? Who's really making these decisions in the background that are putting in place underhandedly a systemic judicial system to divest us of our communities in Brooklyn, Queens, New York that we built? Those values are our values. Mm-hmm. They're not just taking the home, I tell people. It's not just the brick and mortar. It's that value, that $1 million the guy talked about. It's that $2 million in Fort Greene. It's that sense of quiet and comfort that you could hand it over to your children, that your life meant something, as Yusuf said, that you've left something behind. And we have to get this society, even our own leaders and our friends in leadership who don't look like us and our friends in the community, to stand up and say, first and foremost, black people need to have this taken care of.
Right.
We need to take care of it for them, for this society to be whole.
Absolutely. I would think so. We're talking to attorney Yolanda Nicholson. She is with the New York State Foreclosure. She's president of the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar. Is one of the people who has raised this issue loudly. And we're still looking at what we're trying to be clear about is what exactly are we up against right now. We have talked about the legislature has come with legislation. However, you have also pointed out that the legislature's mandate on the courts to save home ownership whenever possible is being circumvented routinely. The courts are disregarding the New York State legislative mandate applying Jim Crow separate standards for foreclosure cases, resulting in high percentage losses of black and brown home ownership across the state. And that is still the condition that we are dealing with right now. Today, destabilization of black and brown communities across New York State continues to accelerate. Black and brown families are being displaced and their tenants evicted. Seniors fall victim to deed and equity theft. I don't know, is everybody clear about deed theft, equity theft? Can you just talk about what is that when we say that they are the victims of deed theft?
Well, you know, when we say they're the victims of deed theft, when we look just at the deed itself, they may go into a closing thinking they're refinancing, mm-hmm. or in the past, or currently they're in foreclosure, and the courts have made it so that they've lost hope, and they have no recourse. Even I have a young lady right now I'm talking to. She's a nurse's aide, and she's got tenants, and she can't, you know, she's facing an auction. So anybody who knocks on her door and gives her an out and puts $10,000 or $20,000, I'm just using her as a general example, mm-hmm. because her whole situation is on black. It's in the public records, and she's like tens of thousands of people. And they would say, well, you know, you're going to lose your home anyway, so let me give you money to move, and maybe $50,000. And she's looking at that as zero because the courts have set her in a position to be zero. So she either signs over her deed, and the house is sitting in Bed-Stuy. So it's worth lots of money. That's the equity theft part of it. Or it could be that they just thought they were in a refinancing, or the person mm-hmm. promised to give them a loan to get out of it, and take their signature, forge it onto a deed, told them they could give them a modification. And mm-hmm. next thing you know, they're facing an eviction. But I think the most prevalent deed and equity theft, and I hate to come back to that, and it's actually not recognizing the law, is the illegal and fraudulent foreclosures that are going on in the courthouses that have created this climate that we are now prey. And once someone steals your deed, they really are stealing not only your current equity, but your children's equity, the intergenerational wealth. So that's why the equity theft part of it is the current and future value, because you no longer have that place in the community. You no longer have that thing to give over. You no longer have that thing with which mm-hmm. fundamentally you can have the pursuit of happiness part of the Bill of Rights, secure mm-hmm. to you and your children. But this climate has all been created by the court system colluding with the financial system to sort of put us in a state of terror where we have no option but to walk away or mm-hmm. sign away or be victimized.
See, now here's my concern when I talk about the priorities and the leadership, and the leadership's priorities are misleading, misguided. For instance, there's the leadership focuses almost singularly on affordable housing. And as you point out, when you use that median income formula, the affordable housing is not really affordable to the folks in the community where these new buildings are going up. But there's this whole emphasis on affordable housing, and they use that terminology a lot because it sounds correct that everybody needs affordable housing. Of course they do. The problem is not actually affordable housing, the lack of affordable housing. The problem is the lack of income. There's nothing being done to change the economic condition of the people in underserved and poor communities. We will leave them in that condition, but we will create some housing that makes it a little bit easier for them to remain poor. That's the formula. That's the thinking around affordable housing. But when I talk about priorities, let me get your thoughts on this. Instead of the emphasis on affordable housing, what about the emphasis on stabilizing the existing housing? Stabilizing the home ownership issues and levels in the black community, the existing black homeowners and businesses, instead of just promising to bring new things into the community, like affordable housing, like a loan fund for business startup, and nobody qualifies. When people go to apply for the loans, nobody qualifies. But instead of those kind of things, I'm saying the priorities ought to be to stabilize the existing Black community. And so in not doing that and watching the Black community come apart while at the same time talking about things like affordable housing, it seems to me that there's a real serious contradiction in terms of priorities there.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you know, affordable housing is a comfortable space for the takers because it's not about home ownership. It's about rental housing. And I tell people when I speak about this that we didn't have an affordable housing crisis, at least not in our communities in New York. It might have been elsewhere, and I may be corrected on this. When we had communities, when Bed-Stuy was owned by Black people, Harlem was owned by Black people, where they could then rent the second floor and third floor to a family or an individual who lived with them long-term at a rental price that and become part of the family and the community. We only have an affordable housing crisis right now because the real estate lobby and the financial lobby in the past 10 to 15 years have been allowed to come take all these homes and all our community and turn them into high-end rentals that people who are working families can't afford to live in them. And the people who are now leading these policy discussions around affordable housing and in particularly land trust find it comfortable to talk about everything but creating ownership, long-term ownership for Black people. Like, that's the key. So I tell people, I don't want to talk about affordable housing before we talk about preserving the HDFCs, which were cooperative home ownership in a city in buildings that were tantamount, or creating rent stabilizations and enforcing rent stabilized apartments so those apartments could be passed from generation to generation, or creating, preserving neighborhoods like Nehemiah Housing, East New York, East Flatbush, which is now on blast. It is now on blast to be totally destroyed. Not just physically, but person by person, family by family, will be pushed out. These guys just knock on their door all day with bags of cash, and sometimes they give up and don't come for the cash. They just say, we're coming to get it whenever you're ready, maybe now or later. So you're absolutely correct. We have a state of emergency, I think. And you know I said that in 2019. We have a state of emergency as to the loss of Black home ownership that is at the level where the state needs to declare a state of emergency. And when you declare a state of emergency, it means you get federal dollars, state dollars, focus on creating, just like when you have a hurricane or a tornado, to fix the problem. Because it can't be that Black people are the people of African descent. Let's just be clear, because everybody is comfortable being away from the Black space. And they got a bunch of Black people that came out of Europe that's in this fight with me. There are a bunch of Black people that came out of South America that's in this fight with me. Light skin, Black skin, white skin, they call it here, brown skin. We gonna all be Black people. You can't create community without ownership. And the society needs to make this a priority agenda. Because if Black people are systemically moved back to predominantly being renters, as was done after Reconstruction, as was done after sharecropping, through sharecropping, we will be back having this conversation, not me and you, but our descendants, 200 years from now, and having no power to vote people into office, no power to make decisions about who teaches in our schools, no power to create role models for our children to be doing something other than wanting, and not to take anything away from a sport icon, but our children have no models anymore. They have there's no money. People in the community don't look like them. Who are they looking?
Absolutely. The wait, let me just. We're going to run out of time, but couple of things. All of that is extremely important to get that out. A couple of things is that. That you pointed out, I want people to hear that clearly, affordable housing is not home ownership. When they talk about affordable housing, they're talking about rental units. Somebody else is going to continue to own the building, own the property. But they're talking about rental units. What we're talking about is a need for generational wealth being moved, passed along. And that comes from ownership. And so the affordable housing initiative works against the developing of generational wealth, maintaining it. It is not about ownership. Ownership is what is key. That is how you create and stabilize a community. I'm saying the priorities of the leadership are absolutely wrong. Rather than focus on stabilizing the existing community, they are allowing the existing historically Black communities to be disassembled, destroyed, and are replacing that home ownership with rental. You got to be clear about that, that affordable housing ploy. And then my research team is listening. They send me this note that says the mayor is not talking about reducing property taxes for homeowners in Bed-Stuy. He's advocating to bring back the policy 421A, the policy that moved luxury condos into those Black areas that pay zero property taxes. It artificially drove up home values in these areas where the existing homeowners have to pay an inflated tax bill. Reducing property taxes under that 421A does not really speak to the need in that community for the existing homeowners. It allows other people to come in, put up condos and luxury buildings and not have to pay any property tax. But the people who are already there are being evicted for not being able to pay the now inflated property tax.
That subsidizes that building.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Those homeowners and the hardworking New Yorkers that were predominantly Black subsidized those buildings.
That's
and
right.
Not only is it pushing up property values, it's pushing up rental values where the people can't afford it and everyone's looking the other way because let's just be clear as well. Those rents are illegal. But we have to, before we end, I just want to say, Bob, this is all happening because we have a society that's not committed to Black home ownership. And we first have the society has to say to its members that since 1619, we've denied Black people these rights. And I'm an immigrant. And everything we came with, we are losing because this society undermines Black home ownership. And I so appreciate you focusing on that, you and your team, and we may be the lone voice for it, but we have to keep this fight up.
Indeed. All right. Now, thank you so much for spending this time with me, helping to bring this information. We appreciate the work that you have been doing consistently. And again, thank you for spending the time with us. I'm Bob Law. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And it is a conversation in the key of life. There are some people that we've talked about how we are so well represented with Black faces in high places. I don't know if we are actually represented at all. Seems to be a great deal of confusion about the extent to which Black folk can identify with the needs of Black folk. So we want to talk a little bit more about that. I want to give you a chance to join the conversation. That I'm at 212-209. I keep losing the numbers that I need here. Y'all remember the number? Sean, what is the call-in number?
212-209-2877.
Thank you. You hear Sean's FM radio voice. Go ahead now. 212-209 2877. You can join the conversation. Here's what I want you to consider. What can we do? I want you to just think about this with me though for a minute, all right? What can we do? What can we do? We don't want to be crushed, discouraged. We want to keep hope alive. We don't want to just keep hoping, but we do want to think strategically. It's one of the things that Dr. King talked about often with the civil rights movement. He called for a kind of creative activism, creative initiatives, and never give up hope. But it was not just the question of not giving up hope. It was also a question of doing the things that are meaningful. So I'm going to open the phone lines and again at 212-209-2877. Let me just give you a little chance to exhale. I want you to think about how we should move forward. Bring it, Sean. This is Conversations in the Key of Life. Think about what you're trying to do to me. I want you to think. You can join this conversation. Now, here's what I want you to do. We talked about taking action. And as I've said here many times, that is what is really necessary. We need another kind of, on the part of all of us, we need to do something more than just talk about it on the radio. When we did Night Talk some years ago, we used to call it Revolutin' on the Radio. We've got to go beyond that. Now, here's what. The mayor, during the mayoral campaign, the mayor agreed that the distribution of development contracts was racist. And that he would commit to giving 20-30% of the development contracts to blacks, not increase the number of the amount of money going to minorities, but instead that he would address the specific need of repairing the damage being done to black developers as a result of racist policies. He agreed, he understood that's what was necessary, but he has not done it. And when we talk about that on a regular basis, y'all don't call his office. That's what I need you to do. you don't call his office. You don't go beyond the correct analysis on the radio. And then we have, when you hear about all of what is going on with deed theft and foreclosure, the kind of things, and these things are being done to affect black people specifically. And the courts are disregarding the New York State legislative mandate. They're applying Jim Crow separate standards for foreclosure cases, resulting in high percentage losses of black and brown ownerships across home ownership across the state. What about the attorney general investigating that? You know, what about in investigating with an intent to change that condition, to eliminate deed theft and illegal foreclosure practices, or at least put it out there and investigated? And then what about the public advocate? And I don't know what the public advocate does. I don't know what the public advocate has the power to do. But, you know, what about the... See, when we talk about these kind of things and then we don't do anything about it, we can have these conversations, but y'all don't call the public advocate's office. Don't ask for any help, any guidance, any direction. So what about that? What about you being willing to follow up these conversations here? And why don't you record this and send it to the public advocate? Say, where are you? Where are you on these in helping the community understand what is going on? Taking some of these positions back to the city council or to the legislature, the state legislature, as the public advocate, on behalf of the public. But be aware of the specific issues that are affecting Black people. You don't have to ignore everything else, but you certainly don't have a right to ignore Black people. You know, what do you think? I don't know if I'm looking at an old note. Sean, we have people. There's somebody. Am I?
Yeah, that's right? A new note.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's go in the few minutes that we have left. Let's take some calls. Hello, I'm Bob Law. This is WBAI. This is A Conversation in the Key of Life. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. My name is Lynn. I'm from New Jersey, and everything your guest spoke about is happening here in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I was calling to find out, do we have a counterpart in New Jersey, someone like her, to help us out, navigate this? Because in New Jersey, the problem is not only Black, it's seniors. Like your guest said, homes that are with very little mortgage or paid for with no mortgage are being, all of a sudden, being taxed out because of the new development. And exactly what she said, where there used to be one house, they changed the zoning law. And all of a sudden, you see a row of condos replacing a single property with four or five in the name of affordable housing.
Well, I don't know if there's her counterpart in New Jersey, but we're working on a show about Newark, New Jersey for next week.
Oh, please. And I can't wait.
We would try to find out who's available.
Not in Newark, but every county in New Jersey is being affected the same way.
Absolutely.
Because we're in Teaneck, and it's ridiculous. Overnight, they changed the zoning laws so you could build a building where there was a house.
I got it. I've got to hurry, but keep listening. We're going to try and address that. All right? You can reach me right now. We have another caller. We have another caller holding on.
Yeah. How you doing, Bob? Listen, I think the answer to all this is understanding. I want to go back a little bit to what you said a couple of weeks ago about devil's food cake and, you know, that classic idea of Malcolm X going to the going to the dictionary and saying, look, when you look up Black, it means everything bad and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That could be racism, and it may have something to do with just the genetic makeup of mankind. We tend to forget that we're Homo sapiens and we lived without electricity. You know, when we were hunter-gatherers and farmers and stuff, they did studies in Africa with newborn Black babies, and the babies turned away from Black faces. Not because the Black faces are ugly, because obviously some of the most good-looking people are from Africa, but because they fear the dark. And I think sometimes we confuse that with racism. Man, it's in our genes that we fear
all right,
the dark.
I got it. Well, this guy comes with some bizarre stuff. It's tempting, though. It's tempting to respond, but it's too silly. You could join me right now, 212-209-2877. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah,
Yeah, Brother Bob, this is Shabazz.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Assalamu alaikum. I had called you before, of course, so we have been in contact. Now, I attempted to email you, gave me an email, but I want a number. Of course, what you're saying, all last, no question, relevant, and we need to address that. What I'm saying now on the air, for everybody's ear, that we need to get some type of assistance. See, and I want to contact you, but I don't have no direct information to reach you, right? Other than calling up on the phone. We need a phone.
I got it. No, I'm not giving out any number on here. Absolutely not. But I will get my folks to check that email. You send it to the WBAI email address, I believe. And there's one other that you could send it to, and I will get the folks on my team to go and check the email. You can also send it to nbla now@gmail.com. And I'll get folks to go check those emails. And see if we can get back to you. All right. That's the only way. That's the best I can do. All right, man. There's another caller standing by. Hello, hello. Sound like Jocko. Hello, hello. Back with the show. This is your engineer. Is there a caller standing by? Or Sean, do we have no more callers?
Is someone saying hello?
Yeah.
They are.
Hello, Bob?
Yes.
Okay, I'm a first-time caller. Okay. I'm a Jamaican guy. And I listen to your program a lot. I'm a person who also believes in Pan-African philosophy. But we in the black neighborhood have a very serious problem. I'm not saying that all of us have that problem, but it seems as if black people own, a lot of blacks don't see a house as a piece of investment.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll find that some of our blacks go into neighborhood, they buy a house together, they run down the neighborhood, a lot of them run down the neighborhood, and then these guys come back and buy the house from them for cheap. We need to change that. Fried Flakes did a very good job in Queens. I wish we could get together with some of these preachers in the church to, you know, put out the word to our mm-hmm. people so that they can see the house as a piece of investment and mm-hmm. not just a box where you go into. That's mm-hmm. where we're losing a lot. Right now, I can tell you, you have like family will come. A mother may work hard, two jobs, four jobs, buy a little house, put their family in it. And the kids then go to school. Next thing you know, they get started, get some money. They move mm-hmm. away from the mother. And then the mother can't keep up the house. Then it run down. And these guys come and buy it off from them for cheap. We need mm-hmm. to get our act together. I'm not saying that the system don't hold us down. But you believe in Pan-African. I believe in Pan-Africa, and I believe in reparation, and I believe that we should be 4 million black people times 40 acres is a lot of land, is equivalent to a state, and that's what we must fight for, not these little sideshow nonsense. We must fight for that 4 million black people who were denied, not to mention what they did to the farmers. They steal the land.
Yeah, we need to mention all of that. No, it's not fair to say not to mention, but I hear you. And I'm going to run out of time. I don't know if there's another caller standing by.
No.
I might. Okay. But I appreciate your call, everybody, trying to help with the thinking. But as I say, why don't you call the mayor's office and ask about that development plan, giving money? Because what the mayor has announced is that he is going to increase the amount of money that goes to minority developers. That's nowhere near what is required, what is necessary to repair the damage done to the black community with those development contracts that have been denied and are still being denied based on in addition to the development, to the development contracts. You also have the lending institutions and refusing to make capital available to black developers. We need to fix that, right? Address that without apology. Be what the black community needs you to be without apology. And it doesn't mean that you don't do anything for anybody else, but it does mean that you make a point to repair the damage being done to the Black community. Specifically, the Attorney General investigating for real this whole issue of deed theft and illegal foreclosure practices and banking institutions refusing to give money to qualified Black borrowers, that the interest rates are higher for Black folk, Black borrowers, that there's a double standard. What about the Attorney General really looking into those conditions that are creating a real hardship for Black people being able to stabilize the Black community? You know, and as we said, it's not so much a question of bringing in this new stuff, affordable housing. I wonder if by now you get it that affordable housing is a bogus plan. Of course, everybody needs to be able to afford a house, afford lodging. That's a given, of course. But affordable housing is not the issue, as much as it is the need for stabilizing what is already there. I hear the music in the background. I have to get out of here. I'm later. I'm running later than I thought. We'll be back next Saturday, and the conversation in the Key of Life will continue. See if we can't look closer at Newark, New Jersey. So stay here at WBAI. Be with us next week. I'm Bob Law. Thank you for spending this morning with me.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. From the Streets with Bob Law came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 1 o'clock is a special from the one and only Gary Null. So please, stay tuned.
A station dedicated to and sponsored by its listeners. From 1960 to present day, WBAI has been promoting an innovative perspective of news, public affairs, music, arts, health, and science. In order to provide a truly unique voice to New York City, WBAI receives its financial assistance from listeners like you. To help WBAI continue this tradition, you can become a BAI buddy by giving a generous monthly donation of as little as $10. It's a safe, secure, and simple way to support your local station. To become a BAI buddy, go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. April 19th through the 23rd, all roads lead to Baltimore, the State of the Black World Conference 5. Organized around the theme, Global Africans Rising, Empowerment, Reparations, and Healing, to address 8 major issue areas. Reimagining policing, gun violence and fratricide, gentrification, environmental justice, water as a human right, socially responsible entrepreneurship, making Black Lives Matter, the role of hip-hop in the Black freedom struggle, and building the U.S. and global reparations movements. The who's who of Black America and the Pan-African world will be in Baltimore, April 19th to the 23rd, for one of the great gatherings of Black people of the century. To check out the amazing program and take advantage of discount registration, go to the website, ibw21.org, That's IBW21.org.
Extinction Diaries. This is the first time Extinction Diaries has highlighted the extinction of a body of water. The nearly 250-acre Lake Kamna Rock in Kenya, Africa, was once home to more than 10,000 crocodiles, 400 elephants, and 13 species of other mammals, including zebras. Today, there is only livestock grazing. Humans moved into the region, began illegal logging, and a booming charcoal business from burnt trees. Pollution, poaching, and raw abuse took every single iconic creature, and now the lake itself is drying into a mudhole from the increasing silt and drought. Sand harvesting is now taking place on former riverbanks. To make matters worse, cartels are extorting money from settlers, and much of the region is becoming lawless. Where once there was forest, there are now houses. Where once there was water, there are now fields. Many locals believe that 2021 will see the complete